Okay, so thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me. So, something does not quite work the way it's supposed to be. Okay, here we go. All right, so there's 45 minutes, 30 minutes for the talk and 15 for the question. I guess I would still encourage you to ask questions as we go. So if you feel like it, I'm happy to answer them. And Vladan is carefully marking the times for those questions so that I can go a little bit longer at the end, undermining the schedule right from the beginning. Okay, good. But this is entanglement stabilization using parity detection and real-time feedback in superconducting circuits. It's done in our lab at ETH Zurich in Switzerland. And there's three main contributors on the postdoc and graduate student level. That's Christian Andersen, Stefania Balasio, and Ans Rem. And Christopher Eichler, who's a senior scientist in our lab, and myself are guiding this work, and we collaborate with Alexandre Blais and Baptiste Royer. And so in the background here, you see a sample that we used for performing the experiments that I'll be discussing. And I hope that I can kind of bring to you a little bit what types of quantum physics experiments you can do with this type of sample and this type of architecture. Okay, so beyond the people who currently work in our lab, so we've been at ETH Zurich now for 13 years, and in that period of time, we've collaborated with quite a few grad students and postdocs successfully, and also with faculty at ETH and also elsewhere whose contributions I acknowledge here. Good, so since I'm giving the first talk on superconducting circuits, I guess I'll give you the one slight introduction to what quantum physics with superconducting circuits is about. I think many of you have probably heard about that previously, and I could probably say interesting things about sort of basic properties of superconducting circuits for quantum physics experiments for like half an hour, and then not get to the main part of my talk. So I'll keep it short here. But I'll hope that I can get back to some of the elements later on. So we're using in our experiment superconducting circuits as components for a quantum information processor. And essentially, we're using two basic types of circuit elements, which we combine. So one of them is combinations of linear inductors and linear capacitors to form harmonic oscillators in quantum electronic circuits. Yeah, and the properties of these harmonic oscillators are then set by the size of the inductors and the size of the capacitors that form these harmonic oscillators. And typically in our devices, inductances and capacitances are chosen such that these oscillators are in the gigahertz frequency range, yeah, with resonance frequencies of about a gigahertz or so. So when we build these circuits and we quantize them, we operate them under conditions that their quantum properties become apparent. We find energy level structures where there's a set of energy levels that are equidistant from each other, where the energy level separation then is set by the resonance frequency of these oscillators. And maybe one aspect that is sort of interesting to note for any electronic circuit is that there's two conjugate variables, flux and charge, that play an important role. So these conjugate variables, flux and charge, are very similar to the conjugate variables position and momentum that you know for a particle in free space. So if you take any electronic circuit and write down its Hamiltonian in terms of flux and charge, yeah, you can then quantize that Hamiltonian by promoting these flux and charge conjugate variables to their corresponding operators, and then just solve the Schrödinger equation for that electronic circuit. And that's really the first step that you do when you analyze any of the quantum mechanical properties of any of these circuits. Okay, so if everything was just linear inductors and linear capacitors, we would essentially be investigating collections of harmonic oscillators in our experiments. And so to make things a bit more interesting, we can also replace this linear inductor here with a nonlinear inductor. And this nonlinear inductor in superconducting electronic circuits is known as a Josephson tunnel junction, yeah, a sandwich between two superconducting electrodes that are connected to each other through a thin tunnel barrier. And this Josephson junction, it provides a nonlinear relationship between the current flowing through that junction and the magnetic flux generated by that current in the junction. So for this harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian itself is quadratic in both flux and charge. And one way to think about the physics of it is to think about a physics of a particle whose effective mass is given by the inverse of the capacitance in a quadratic potential set by the flux variable. Yeah? And that's so this quadratic potential then gives you this linear energy level spectrum. In this unharmonic oscillator where the linear inductor is replaced by the Josephson junction, that potential part is not quadratic in flux, but it's cosinusoidal in the flux. So it's some potential that then for higher energy opens up in a cosinusoidal fashion. And what happens instead of having linear equidistantly spaced energy levels in a harmonic oscillator, now you have energy levels whose energies move closer to each other as the energy rises in this cosinusoidal potential. And that leads to the fact that for these unharmonic oscillators, then the ground to first excited state transition frequency is a little bit larger than the first to second excited state transition frequency. And the difference in these two energies is typically called alpha, and that's called, or that we also refer to as the unharmonicity. And you can write this Hamiltonian here also in a second quantized fashion of this sort, where you see that the second excitation gets this extra energy reduction by alpha. And so if you want to do quantum physics with these superconducting electronic circuits, you essentially combine these harmonic oscillators and unharmonic oscillators in particular ways, and you can use the unharmonic oscillators as qubits, and in the harmonic oscillators you can store linear excitations. Okay, so that's my one slide introduction to superconducting circuits, and I think that maybe gives you enough of the background for why this should work quantum mechanically and as an introduction to the kind of experiments that I'll be presenting to you. So what we've done in the past few years, we've worked on an architecture that combines these different circuit elements, harmonic oscillators and non-harmonic oscillators, in sort of interesting fashions to perform quantum optics experiments and to perform experiments for quantum information processing. And I'll present to you some of the outcome of that work on this architecture, and just start out with maybe mentioning a few results that we had in the past 2 years on that actually allowed us to develop our work in quite interesting ways. So first, we've found a combination of these unharmonic and harmonic oscillator circuits that allows us to perform very fast and high fidelity readout on superconducting circuits. So indeed, we are able now to perform a single shot, about 99% fidelity readout in just about 50 nanoseconds. And that's close, I think that's still holding currently the record for the fastest and highest fidelity, or the combination of fastest and highest fidelity readout in superconducting circuits. With the same type of approach, we're able to kind of at the beginning of some calculation or at the end of some calculation to initialize our qubits in its ground state through something that we would call an unconditional reset. And this unconditional reset is something where we can start out with any combination of initial state in our qubits and reset it to the ground state in a passive way. Then this approach that I'll presenting to you is multiplexible. We can use these ideas and scale them up in a relatively easy fashion in an integrated circuit. And we've done that so far with up to 8 qubits. And then the main part of my talk will be about using this type of architecture to perform measurements of parity in a set of 3 qubits, where we use 2 data qubits and 1 ancilla qubits to perform ZZ and XX stabilizer measurement, and iteratively use those to stabilize a Bell state in these circuits, which is one of the steps that is relevant for error correction in superconducting electronic circuits. And the same approach we've also demonstrated last year is capable of mapping quantum information from a localized excitation in a superconducting anharmonic oscillator, localized qubit, map that into a photon and send that photon along some transmission line to some different chip currently in the same cryostat, and sort of to transfer quantum information quite efficiently between non-locally between different chips in a superconducting electronic circuit setup. And again, the same kind of combination of elements can be used for performing a single shot, single photon detection quite efficiently. And so I list some of the works that we've done here on this slide so that you could maybe ask me about them later. And the focus of this talk will be on that part. Okay, so if you've been here since some time earlier this morning, you've seen this slide on the screen, which shows to you the chip on which we have done this Bell state stabilization experiment. So I thought it might be interesting to you to kind of walk you a little bit through that chip and tell you what are the elements of that chip, so that maybe if you look at papers from that topic area, you can maybe recognize elements of it. So this is a circuit. This chip itself is a few millimeters on the side. So this here is maybe 4 millimeters, and this is about 10 millimeters. Every one of these yellow crosses here are one of these superconducting unharmonic oscillators. These yellow crosses provide a capacitor, and this capacitor is shorted to ground in a region that I indicate here by my laser pointer through a Josephson tunnel junction, and that gives you this unharmonic oscillator qubit-style structure. And there's four of them that you see in every position of this chip. And then each individual qubit, you can control its quantum state in two different ways. So there's one line here, which is the green line at every qubit, and that allows us to apply short current pulses to that line. And these short current pulses couple magnetic flux into a squid-like structure that is part of this superconducting qubit. And with that, we are able to tune the transition frequency of the qubit on nanosecond time scales. And that's something that we use to induce two-qubit gates, as I'll explain more later. Then there's also like these purple gate lines here, and these purple gate lines allow us to apply short microwave frequency pulses to every individual qubit to manipulate its state. For example, starting from the ground state, we could prepare an equal superposition state or an excited state. Then the nearest neighbors are coupled through microwave frequency strip line resonators. So what you see here, this extended structure, is a coplanar waveguide resonator that allows two neighboring qubits to exchange excitations by either exchanging real photons through the resonator or by exchanging virtual photons through the resonator. And here, if you stare carefully at it, you see that there's something interesting going on. This is a sort of a stepped impedance resonator that allows us to enhance the vacuum fluctuations a little bit and then bring the coupling strength between neighboring qubits up a little. And so you see that neighboring qubits are coupled in this linear topology, even though that wraps around along this chip just for space reasons. And then what is also interesting here is that every one of those qubits is coupled to a little coplanar waveguide readout resonator. It's a lambda quarter resonator, which is shorted at this end, and then has a lambda quarter wavelength along this orange part, which then capacitively couples to the qubit. And depending on the state of the qubit, the resonance frequency of this capacitively readout resonator will be shifted. It will be shifted by a few megahertz out of its few gigahertz transition frequency. And this frequency shift we can use to perform single-shot measurements of the qubit state. And all of these readout resonators here, there's four ones for one individual, one for each qubit. Those can be read out in a multiplexed fashion through this purple line here. We can apply microwave pulses in a frequency multiplexed fashion simultaneously to all of these four resonators and read out the qubit state simultaneously. So that's one of our efforts to sort of bring the overhead down for extending our circuits to larger sizes. And then there's also another set of lambda quarter resonators connected to these lambda quarter readout resonators, and those are so-called Purcell filters. And those allow us to get these readout resonators very large bandwidth and couple them strongly to these superconducting qubits without adversely affecting the qubit lifetime through the Purcell effect. And on this type of architectural setup, we've done the experiments that I've explained to you on the last slide. And so let me now move ahead and explain to you how we did essentially stabilize a Bell state through qubit 1 and qubit 3 here by performing parity measurements through an Ancilla qubit, which is qubit 2 in this corner. Okay, so why would you be interested in thinking about parity reset and correction? So our motivation for thinking about this came from contributions that we're having to develop superconducting circuits for quantum information processing in the context of error correction. And one of the goals there is to realize surface code with superconducting circuits, and we're obviously not the only ones thinking about that. There's all the major players like IBM and Google, and quite a few of the academic labs are developing these types of circuits where you essentially have a set of data qubits that are shown here in red, and a set of Ancilla qubits that are used to measure the parity of the data qubits either in the X basis using this blue Ancilla qubits here, or in the Z basis using the green Ancilla qubits. And so realizing this, this kind of architecture, this kind of arrangement of qubits would allow you, using the surface code, to perform error correction on superconducting circuits. So for the surface code, for realizing the surface code, you would need to perform so-called weight 4 stabilizer measurements with these X Ancilla qubits. It's a weight 4 XXXX stabilizer, or the equivalent for the Z operator. And at the edge of this region that is shown here by the thick black line, you would also be able, you would also be required to perform weight 2 XX and ZZ parity measurements on that type of architecture. And demonstrating these parity measurements and the identification of changes in this parity and acting on detected changes in the parity is one of the goals that you would need to achieve for realizing error correction in superconducting circuits. And obviously, there's been prior work in that direction, quite a bit of prior work by, for example, Leo DiCarlo's lab, or also IBM, and also by the team of John Martinez at Google, where weight 2, both weight 2 and weight 4 parity checks have been performed using logical 2-qubit gates between data qubits and Ancilla qubits. One thing that has, however, not been done is so far all the experiments on error correction in superconducting circuits have not really instantiated any feedback based on the detection of an error. Yeah, all those experiments have essentially noted the error, have written it down in the memory, and then have done something that is known as Pauli frame update to take into account the error. But none of the experiments really did go through the analysis scheme of identifying the error and then really correcting it. And so this is something that we decided to do, and our lab was set up for that reasonably well, because we did do feedback experiments on superconducting circuits before. Namely, we used feedback in a teleportation experiment quite some time ago. And also Leo DiCarlo's group has some similar results in using feedback to create entangled states by measurements. And I should also mention that Jonathan Holmes' group at ETH, working with IONS, has used a scheme that is very closely related to what I will present to you just last year, and they had this very nice publication which essentially has realized the same approach as I'll show to you in superconducting circuits now. And so our goal was to do repeated parity correction on a multi-qubit device using feedback, and just convince ourselves that we would be able to use these schemes then also in a that we would be hopeful to use these schemes in a larger context in error correcting superconducting circuits. Okay. So let me tell you conceptually what we were trying to do. So one thing that we decided as the goal for our experiment, we wanted to use stabilizer measurements and feedback to stabilize any of these four Bell states in principle. But the experiments that I'll show to you actually worked on trying to stabilize this particular Bell state 0, 0 plus 1, 1 over square root of 2. And what you see here for the four different Bell states are the XX operator eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1 corresponding to these different types of Bell states, both for the XX and the ZZ operator. And so what you see here is that's the Bell state with even parity in the Z basis for the two qubits, so both qubits are either 0 or 1. And for example, if an error would occur on that type of Bell state, a bit flip error would occur. So for example, the second qubit would flip from 0 to 1, so that would turn into a 0, 1 plus 1, 0 state. And that you could identify by measuring the ZZ parity of that state, and you would find out that the ZZ parity value would now be minus 1. Yeah? And this way you could detect the error. And you could also correct for that error by having noted the occurrence of that parity change, and then by applying a pi pulse on the second qubit, you can correct that error and get back to this this 5 plus Bell state. And a similar thing you could do in the X basis, where essentially detecting a change of the sign of the XX stabilizer would allow you to perform again a pi pulse on the second qubit to correct for that parity change in the XX basis. And if you can repeatedly measure XX and ZZ parities and detect potential parity eigenvalue changes and react on them by applying correction pulses, you can go for stabilizing this 5 plus Bell state, which is what we did in our experiments. Okay, so so here's this chip that I've shown to you already previously. Here you see again the scale bar and labels for all the elements on this device, which has everything that we need for implementing this this task, for realizing this task. Okay, so maybe let's zoom in a little bit on one of these qubits here, which is shown on the next slide. It's this yellow structure here. At the top end of it, you see the Josephson tunnel junctions, and zooming in further into this area here, the two Josephson tunnel junctions sit in these two points here, indicated by my green laser pointer. And now we can, for example, send current pulses through this flux line here. These current pulses will induce magnetic flux in this loop, and that allows us to tune the transition frequency of these qubits. So this device was fully made in our labs at ETH Zurich, and here some of the coherence properties are listed. So typical qubit lifetimes that we now achieve in our lab are several tens of microseconds. You see that there's a fair amount of scatter in these qubit T1s. And maybe to give you an overall scale, is typically the best devices that large labs like at IBM or Google or also at Yale realize are on the order of maybe a close to 100 microseconds or so. So this is, say, between a factor of 3 or 5 to the best possible qubit coherence values. But what is also good to see is that the not only the energy relaxation times are on the order of several tens of microseconds, but also the coherence times on a similar scale. So then the question is, how good does this sample perform as a small quantum information processor with a few qubits? So one of the experiments that we did is we performed randomized benchmarking to characterize single qubit gates. And this characterization allows us to determine the fidelity of our single qubit gates. And we've done that on all four of the qubits on this device, both individually and simultaneously. And what we find is that our single qubit gate fidelity is on the order, or the single qubit error, or the gate infidelity is on the order of a fraction of a percent. And maybe the very best experiments, if you shorten your gate times a little bit, the very best experiments have maybe on the order of 10 to the minus 3 error, or a little bit below that currently, if you work really hard on your calibration and maybe have a little bit better coherence and shorter pulse lengths. But this is fairly respectable, on a below half a percent error for individual single qubit gates. So what about our two qubit gate fidelity? So the two qubit gates get instantiated by tuning the transition frequencies of the individual qubits. So when what we do is we do a so-called controlled phase gate, and this controlled phase gate induces a phase on a state, which is the EE state. That's when both qubits are in the second excited state. This EE state we can bring into resonance with a state where one of the qubits is in the ground state and the other one is in the second excited state. And we can bring those two in resonance by tuning the transition frequency of one of the qubits into resonance with the other qubit. And then we control that interaction time in a way that this EE excitation will swap once into the GF state and then back, and perform a 2π rotation, and then leave a phase factor of minus 1 on this EE state, whereas these EG, GE, and GG states remain without a phase factor. And that's kind of the controlled phase gate that we use to instantiate controlled NOT gates between pairs of qubits. And here we've characterized the quality of these two qubit gates by using process tomography, and we've done process tomography between qubit 1 and qubit 2, and also between qubit 2 and qubit 3. And this process tomography again, results in gate fidelities which are on the order of 99% or close to 99%. Again, that's maybe not the very best gate that you might ever have seen, but it's pretty respectable. So one of the special features of this chip that I've mentioned to you is that it allowed to perform multiplexed readout of multiple qubits simultaneously by just applying frequency multiplexed pulses to this common feed line that you have seen. And here are some of this readout parameters. So we can do perform readout in readout timescales of, say, only a few hundred nanoseconds, and perform those simultaneously on all four qubits on this device. And we've performed a more detailed analysis on the crosstalk between the different qubits, but I could summarize it by saying that the individual qubit readout is on the order of 99%, and independent of whether we read out the qubits individually or jointly. Okay, so how do we use these elements then to perform repeated weight 2 ZZ and XX parity measurements? So here's a little quantum circuit diagram. So what we start out with is we have two data qubits, qubit 1 and qubit 3, and we prepare them in an equal superposition state, qubit 1 and qubit 3, by applying a pi half pulse to it. And we leave the ancilla qubit in the ground state. And then what we can do is we can measure the parity of the data qubit 1 and data qubit 2 by performing a CNOT gate between the respective data qubit and the ancilla qubit. And so our CNOT gates are realized by controlled phase gates combined with single qubit gates. So the combination of these four gates here, two single qubit gates, two qubit gates, performs two CNOT gates, one between the data qubit 1 and the ancilla, and one between the data qubit 2 and the ancilla. And that essentially determines the parity of data qubit 1 and data qubit 2. And then we can read out the ancilla qubit in single shot. We can reset the ancilla qubit to its ground state. And depending on whether we've witnessed a change in the parity of the two data qubits, we can perform a feedback pulse on one of the data qubits. Okay, and at the end, we verify whether our procedure has worked. And so this here is now, this gate sequence here shows you like a ZZ parity measurement, or a parity measurement of the ZZ operator. And we can turn that ZZ parity measurement into an XX parity measurement by performing a basis change. So we rotate the two data qubits into the X basis and then perform the same gate set. And so here in this musical notation with these repetition marks here, we can now perform ZZ parity measurements by instantiating this gate set, and XX parity measurements by instantiating this larger gate set with the basis changes. And then we can repeat the combination of ZZ and XX parity measurements and look what state we create doing that. And so the first thing that we did is we actually analyzed our gate sequence without performing the single shot readout and the feedback, but just performing the coherent part and verifying the final state by doing 3-qubit tomography. And that's what's shown here. So that's a 3-qubit tomography on this register for performing the coherent part of that algorithm. And we can compare that state with what our expectations would be. And the fidelity of that state at the end of the coherent part is about 95%. Fidelity with respect to the ideal state without any gate errors or coherence errors. And when we simulate that, we see that the reduction in fidelity is compatible with what we would simulate. So then the next thing that you could do is to kind of predict what your actual readout outcomes would be. You could project out on the computer the ancilla qubit state and see what you would find. And if you would just on the computer project out this ancilla qubit state for positive ZZ parity for the ZZ eigenvalue plus 1, you would find 1 Bell state. And for the ZZ eigenvalue minus 1, you would find the other Bell state. Yeah? And what we would now want to do is, like, using the information from the single shot readout, we want to turn this Bell state into that by applying a single qubit pulse to it. And that's what's then shown here. So we can perform a ZZ parity measurement and use the feedback to stabilize that belt state by applying a pi pulse if needed to the second data qubit. And that stabilizes that phi plus belt state with a fidelity of about 85% or so. And that would only look at the ZZ parity. And now to also stabilize the phase, you would need to stabilize ZZ and XX. And thank you. And the result of that is the stabilization of the phi plus belt state for essentially an infinite or for a longer, an amount of time that is longer than the duration of the individual gate sets. And this here is my last slide. And that summarizes the results here. So what is plotted here is the belt state fidelity versus the stabilization cycles n. And the stabilization cycle is an ZZ parity measurement plus feedback, an XX parity measurement plus feedback. And what is shown here is the belt state fidelity when you instantiate only the ZZ stabilizer and feedback. And if you use only the ZZ stabilizer and feedback, you see that dephasing reduces the belt state fidelity with time as you apply more feedback cycles. But if you do ZZ and XX measurements, you actually preserve the belt state fidelity. And you could analyze that in more detail by looking at the eigenvalues of the ZZ operator and the XX operator. But as the chairman is getting nervous so that we have the 15 minutes for the discussion, you can maybe ask about that later. And I'll finish here. Say that we've demonstrated this way two parity measurements of the ZZ and XX operator. We've stabilized the belt state in 12 rounds and achieve a fidelity of 74% with that. And it's an important element for error correction scheme in superconducting circuits. And obviously, we'd like to extend that to wait for stabilizer measurements in the future. Okay, and then I'll finish with just showing you my summary slides here with the references. Also, the work that I've presented to you is discussed here in this paper, which is available on the archive, and I would be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andreas, for this very interesting presentation. I would remind people who ask questions that they should speak into the microphone so that the question gets recorded.
So this looks really very nice. Obviously, the question is, it looks completely stable, right? So what prevents you from going further at the moment, or what limits the whole thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we had we would have liked to have more feedback cycles in our experiment. So one of the aspects that we're working on is we're actually collaborating with a ETH startup company, Zurich Instruments, on doing the electronics for these experiments. And these electronics were actually commercial electronics. So anybody could buy that and do this real-time feedback. And since while it's commercial, it was still in a demo stage, we couldn't really fit more sequences into the memory and maintain the experiment. But there should, I think, as far as we understand, there should be no limitation, and we could have continued to run that forever. And we've also analyzed why it comes out at that fidelity and what limits it. And there were also some interesting aspects how the experiment instantiating the feedback and not just doing polyframe updating differed from each other.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, related to the previous question, how much does it spend on the feedback delay?
Ah, okay, good. Yeah, so that I was maybe a little bit rushed at the end. So, for example, if you followed carefully how the fidelity for goes down, yeah, then the first thing that you notice that initially, sort of the initial fidelity is roughly 95%, and that's based on our gate fidelities and the decoherence while instantiating the gates. Then if you, on the computer, project out the Ancilla qubit, you essentially get the same fidelity. Yeah? It's also close to 94%. Then if you realize the feedback, then the feedback delay time is on the order of a microsecond. So during that time period of time, you get hit by the extra decoherence. And that reduces the fidelity down to about 86% for one round of ZZ stabilizer measurements. When you do ZZ and XX stabilizer measurements, you have to do two rounds of feedback. So you have these two feedback delays of about a microsecond each. And then makes you end up with 75% fidelity. And one thing that I couldn't dwell on too much is what you see here, that the time scales where we apply the single qubit or pulses on the two data qubits, which are a sort of a dynamic decoupling scheme for these data qubits. These are the times that our electronics needs to analyze the readout results and to actually apply the feedback pulse to the data qubits. So if you like, the best way to improve that would be to reduce that feedback time. So the single largest enhancement in fidelity would be expected by having faster electronics. And I think we're reasonably optimistic that we can maybe cut that time by a factor of 3 or so in this experiment.
So maybe a little related question. So you are saying that you are limited by the how fast is your electronic part, but you are also limited by your coherence time.
Yeah,
so
that's
correct.
So I
would like to know a little bit what is the physical reason for this limitation coherence time.
Ah, yeah, that's a very good question. It's on my open question slide. We understand it at the moment as being largely limited by surface defects. Yeah? Defects on the top of semiconducting or insulating surfaces, on the top of superconducting surfaces. And there's quite a range of indications that that's actually the dominant problem. But there's no good understanding how to solve this problem currently in either in fabrication or by other mitigation techniques. But there's a really a range of good indications that that show that it's individual, like a collection of a large number of defects at the surface that limits coherence at these current levels.
Nice talk, Andreas. I was just curious, maybe on a not really related topic, but on the side of imperfections, to what extent is your qubit a qubit, and to what is the, do you have magnitude of the leakage in this qubit?
Ah, okay. So yeah, so that's an interesting question also. So one of the problems that Jonathan Holm did exactly the same experiment in his system with ions, and he actually observed a drop in the fidelity with time. And one of the problems that he identified was that in his he used a species that has hyperfine states, and there was some leakage between hyperfine states. And so his the qubits go from the qubit state space into other hyperfine substates, from which he couldn't recover in his experiment. So in our experiments, like the predominant leakage path would be towards the F level, the second excited state in our qubit. And if you could either detect that leakage or prevent it, that would also help. And I think we have some indication, and Leo Di Carlo has done a similar experiment, where he also has some indication that one of the error sources are leakage into this F level. And one of the ways this could happen is because the C phase gate gets realized by having a full 2 pi cycle through that second excited state. And if your 2 pi rotation through that second excited state is not complete, then you might end up with a little leftover population there, which you need to address, either detect and then correct for, or calibrate away at a sufficient level of detail that it won't matter in the experiment in the end.
You don't have a quantitative number for your system.
It's much less than a percent how large it is, and in our case I don't know. And one of the ways how we tackle that is, for example, our qubit reset that we've realized that does not only reset the first excited state but also the second excited state, which is a nice feature, and that's discussed in this PRL that we had published at the beginning of last year. And leakage is known to be a problem, and obviously leakage is a large problem in any error correction scheme. Yeah, if your qubits leak out of their computational subspace, your error correction code would need to be addressing that in some way, and that could really be a major problem that you need to investigate. And these superconducting circuits, they have a range of excited state. There's not only a second excited state, but a third excited state, and you need to control leakage into those subspaces.
So I'm wondering about running this as an open quantum system. If you have your same circuit and you, you know, do poor parity measurements, or you do them too slowly, or you, you know, you do other things, have you explored possibilities for what kinds of states you might drive the system toward, if there are any preferred states, if you have a, you know, a noisy or worse performance?
You mean what the state is that we generate at the end of the sequence, considering all the non-idealities in those sequences?
For example.
Yeah, we've looked, so we've performed master equation simulations on the full protocols to try to understand what the main error sources are. And one of the interesting experiments that we did was to not realize the feedback, but just do this polyframe updating and just analyze the data based on that. And the results are actually different in an interesting way when we don't reset the ancilla qubits. For example, there's an extra error channel that opens up, because then the ancilla qubit can decay from the excited state back down to the ground state and open up another error channel. And we can wonder, how does that reflect in the data that we get? And we're sort of in the process of analyzing that data further to understand what the different error mechanisms are and how they actually affect this type of scheme.
Thank you.
I was curious, to what extent do you have classical crosstalk?
That's also an interesting question. So that's something that we look at, and you would, so that could then be identified as part of a coherent error that could happen between qubits. So one of the ways how we avoid classical crosstalk is that in our current devices, each qubit has its own single qubit gate, every one of the qubits is operated at a different frequency. And the combination of that reduces the crosstalk between different qubits to a fairly small level. So, and we've tried to characterize that by doing randomized benchmarking on each qubit individually, but also doing randomized benchmarking on all qubits simultaneously, and look at how the fidelities that we get from those measurements differ. And I think the crosstalk-induced error, that's also on a small fraction of a percent currently, but it's certainly something that one needs to look at. And one of the aspects that we would in the future try to work on is, for example, here you see that we have this multiplexed readout for all four qubits, and we were trying to understand, for example, if you were sending a readout pulse on this qubit, does it affect any of the other qubits at all? Yeah? And that's another type of crosstalk measure. Like, you could measure the cross measurement induced dephasing on a different qubit. Yeah? The one, your target qubit, you want to fully dephase and extract the state information, but none of the other qubits you want to dephase at all. And that's one of the error mechanisms. And these filters that we've realized here, they help suppressing these types of errors. And they were also, again, on the order of a small fraction of a percent. But those you would like to suppress as much as you can. And you could maybe think about multiplexing qubit drives in a similar way by connecting every one of the qubits to such a filter combination and then applying the drives through the same line also. And what you need to minimize then is this qubit crosstalk, which is very important. Also for the two-qubit gate, some similar quantities would be of interest.
I think we have time for one more question.
How's that crosstalk during the two-qubit gates? I might have misinterpreted, but I thought that you were moving one qubit frequency, moving it around so that that qubit is resonant with another qubit.
Yep.
And then aren't you moving through other qubits' frequency? So what is it?
That's a good question. So when the two-qubit gates are realized by moving qubits around in frequency space, it depends on choosing a clever staggered arrangement so that unintentional resonances between qubits don't occur. And Leo Di Carlo has a nice paper that, for example, for this surface code lattice, you can identify a staggering of qubit frequencies and a sequence of gates that avoids these accidental interactions.
So that doesn't limit the system size significantly?
Generally, this would maybe be not true, but for a specific set of gates, like in the surface code that you need to implement, I think you can avoid these unintentional resonances. And then there's also, again, like for the two-qubit gate, there's also a version of the classical crosstalk. Yeah, you're trying to tune the transition frequency of one qubit, but if there's a little bit of flux crosstalk to the other, that will be acting like a Z gate on one of the qubits, which you also would like to minimize, either detect and have some right echoing pulses or have the physical crosstalk to be as small as possible.
Let us thank Andreas for the questions as well.
Thank you.